This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, together with Health and Living producer Tina Camellia. So we've been a health show on air for about 7 to 8 years, give or take. But in April, we finally had our very first health event. And since this series is dedicated to looking back at the best of 2016, we certainly couldn't look past our very first. It was kind of like our baby.
And the theme for this event was to answer Malaysia's most pressing health questions. We kicked off the event with Mira Sivasodhi having a frank chat with Health Minister Dato' Sri Dr. S. Subramaniam for an overview of the health ecosystem in the country.
We are the fattest nation in Southeast Asia. We all know that. We lead in terms of diabetics in Southeast Asia. Putrajaya is the fattest city in Southeast Asia. How did that happen? What it's saying is our civil servants are not in the best shape, Dato' Sri. As a nation, as civil servants, where have we gone wrong?
Thanks, Mira. First, I think Jason, while introducing you, saying that listening to your voice can be diabetogenic. So I had to be exceedingly careful in our close relationship which we have here. Thank God diabetic is not an infectious disease. Now, coming back to your question, but I don't think you can look at Putrajaya in isolation, but Putrajaya is, of course, is a unique community because it sees a collection of certain group of people, of civil servants, the middle-class civil servants who lead a sedentary life. So unless you compare similar groups in other places, you might not be able to get a fair comparison between whether similar segments of society in other areas also have got the same demography. But having said that, I think I was the one who gave the statement to the Star yesterday that we are the fattest, most obese, not knowing that I'm going to come here today and you're going to ask me this question. If you had known this, probably I would have delayed that answer 2 days. So having said that, so that is the figure. I mean, this is worrying. I mean, beyond Putrajaya to Malaysians, I think the fact that obesity figures show, I think 47% of Malaysians are overweight and 30% obese, and that is not something which we can be proud of. And you can see this trend coming post-independence. It's slowly creeping up as our lifestyle changes from a very active agriculture-based population to a more urban society which is involved in non-physical activity. So that is one contributory factor. Now, as I always say, physical activity has become a luxury, not a necessity. When physical activity was a necessity, that you have to work to your place of work, or work from one rubber tree to another rubber tree, then it becomes part and parcel of your daily life. So you need not invest in remaining fit. But now it's gone beyond that point, because most of us drive to your office and then you get down, probably walk straight into the office, and there's hardly any need for physical activity. So you have to invest in physical activity. Then once physical activity becomes a luxury, is it something which is available to everybody, or is it only available to certain segments of society? And whether the overall environment is enabling to allow for this. And I think along the process of development, I must admit we have made mistakes, that we have not developed societies or communities or townships which actually proactive, actually allows for physical activity as such. So that is on one part. Obesity, as you will ask any medical profession, leading cardiologists, they will tell you that it is a balance between intake and output. When the intake is above more than the output, then it gets stored. And this storage is what we are seeing. So it's either you reduce the intake or you increase the output. That is the simple mechanism to that. So we are at fault on both sides. Our intake is excess, the output is less. So that is the contributory factor. Intake is excess because the Malaysian culture is very food-centered. Meetings are food-centered. Socialization is food-centered. We can't do anything without food. In my ministry, we got 5 meetings. We got a caterer which will change the plate of food for every meeting.
See, now you know why Putrajaya is the fattest city.
So
you need to cut down on your coffee.
These are the cultural things which we need to change. Cultural things which you change how we look at things. So can we socialize without food?
We can.
Can we have meetings without food? And can that transition be done? So this is the mindset change which Malaysians have done. One, and can we choose the correct kind of food? I mean, knowledge is good, but behavior, transition of knowledge into behavioral change, that's a difficult thing. So if that is done on one part, on the intake part, then you go into the output part, is to invest time, effort in physical activity. So we are pushing this agenda, Unfortunately, we are not seeing the results. So government can give the correct messages, and I probably have to disagree with the original statement that government tells us what to do and we have not much say in that. You have every say in deciding what food you want to eat. The government doesn't dictate to you what you want to eat. And you have every say in having a right to exercise, to move, to run, whatever you do. The government has not reached the level of telling you not to run or not to walk. So you still have a choice. So it's Malaysians should make the correct choice. And that transformation is absolutely important in this war against obesity.
But so that's not happening.
That's not.
So what do we do?
Tell them, come, let's change. Maybe when you tell, they might listen. Maybe when I tell, they might say it's got political incentives inside it.
We know that the current health system, in terms of refinancing the cost of healthcare in the country, it is not sustainable going forward. What do we have planned? We spoke about the One Care policy a few years ago. It was politicized. It was shelved. Right. So where are we going with this? We cannot go on the way we are.
Right. If you look broadly, globally, the health systems can be based on two methods of financing. One is method of financing of general taxation like what we're doing, which is done in the Scandinavian countries. They all follow this pattern of financing based on general taxation. Or it's on a people's insurance contribution policy like what happens in the United States and other parts of the world. But the only difference between the general taxation, which is done in Malaysia, and the general taxation done in the Scandinavian countries, is in Malaysia, a lot of Malaysians don't pay tax. So the number who pay tax is very small. If our general taxation remains the way which we have now, then you expect the government to give you that service. Economically, I'm not an economist, but I think even in the common sense economy, that is not going to work because the amount you're receiving is very little and the amount you're expecting is too far. That's why the taxation is concerned. The insurance, of course, is asking people to contribute, which has been raised again and again, but it has become a political issue. Even when we wanted to increase the 1 ringgit in the outpatient department to 2 ringgit, people didn't say it's 2 ringgit, it says 100% hike. So that is the Malaysian perception. In Malaysia, you give anything, you want to take it back, it's very, 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 very difficult. So with that, I think it's an educational process trying to tell the public that nothing comes free. What we have done now is now to create the awareness. Now we are trying to give them itemized bill. You go to hospital, they are supposed to give you a bill saying that, hey, look here, your stay here is 12,000 ringgit, but the government has given you 99% discount. This is the bill. So at least they are aware that there's a value. There's a value to what was done for you. Otherwise, we have this perception problem. Anything which you pay money has got value. Anything which has got free has got no value. So we have to break this perception problem.
Is it also got to do with priorities? How much of funding is actually coming towards health? The WHO says countries should spend at least 5% of GDP on health.
Okay,
we're spending less than 5%?
See, our total expenditure on healthcare is 4.4% of GDP, half coming from private, half coming from public. And of course, different countries spend different. America spends about 17 to 18% of GDP. But despite that, President Obama has not managed to solve Obamacare. So if you look at dollar to dollar, for our 4.4% of GDP, we have actually achieved much more than most of the countries who are spending 8 to 9% of GDP. So in that sense, we have got an efficient system, which has given us value for money. Whether increasing this is the only answer, yes. But if you look at the overall budgetary thing, Ministry of Health gets the highest amount of budget next to the Ministry of Education. We can push it a bit further, but You need other things. You also need roads. You need bridges. So we have to work out a good deal.
Also talking about our number one killer, and you'll find out what that is. Uma Pagan Apikipagan spoke to Dr. Zanaria Hussein, consultant endocrinologist, Mary Isaw John, who's the chief dietitian of Institute Jantung Negara, and Dr. Azani Dawood, consultant cardiologist, and Datuk Dr. Venugopal Balchan, consultant cardiothoracic surgeon, to debunk the myths about heart disease, diabetes, and hypertension.
Hypertension is something we don't necessarily talk about a lot. We talk about a lot about heart disease, a lot of statistics about how it's a killer. Diabetes is something that's huge. Is hypertension just all about salt, as diabetes is about sugar and carbs?
Okay, a few facts about hypertension first. It is probably the single biggest contributor to death in the world. In Malaysia, we only diagnose 40% of patients with hypertension. So for every four that we diagnose, there are another six outside who are undiagnosed. Most patients with hypertension have no symptoms. And in Malaysia, if you have no symptoms, you don't go and see a doctor because you'd rather not know. I don't know. I jumpa doktor nanti dia tak, ini lah, sini sudah, tak boleh makan, ini tak boleh makan.
Yeah, before I saw the doctor, I didn't have anything.
Yeah, when I see the doctor. And then when you are in private, I mean, the doctor want to make money only. Which is not true. Unfortunately, in this country, we will get at least six new stroke cases a day. Coming back to salt, is it all about salt? As far as the diet is concerned, salt is probably the biggest contributor to high blood pressure. It has been estimated that Malaysians consume double the recommended amount of salt per day. If we could, as a population, if you could reduce the salt intake, you would probably be able to reduce blood pressure more than any drugs could ever do. But a lot of people forget, you know, some people say, oh, but I eat Japanese food, doctor, very healthy, all fish, raw fish. And then you dip it in the soya sauce, right? Okay, so that sort of thing. But hypertension is not just salt, okay? Like most of the diseases that we are talking about today, it's a lifestyle problem.
Mary, do you just want to chime in on the salt issue before I get to diabetes?
The DASH diet, dietary approaches to stop hypertension, shows the reason why certain people, although they have high salt intake, but they have fantastic intake of fruits and vegetables. And it's only five serving. Patients say, huh? Lima, mau makan satu kebun ke? It's not. Five servings means half cup cook, one cup salad, which is your ulam or whatever. The balance three is your fruits. Now the problem is, when it comes to durian, everybody keeps quiet. Okay? Because they don't eat ulas, they eat biji.
With rice and santan.
Yes. So, vegetables and fruits, if you see that you can increase this at least five servings, and then they ask you which kind of fruits and vegetables, just add color la, rainbow.
You know, all of the things we're talking about today, the heart disease, the diabetes, the hypertension, I mean, they are the consequence of our life of abundance, right? It's a lifestyle disease. And diabetes is one of those diseases. Now, what I do want to know is, can you, for example, reverse diabetes? And what does it take to reverse type 2 diabetes?
There are situations where diabetes may be reversed, or what we say may be controlled, or maybe even use the term cure. But these are very few situations. For example, if you are taking medications that predispose to getting your glucose up, and some people need to take steroids for certain chronic conditions, and these medications make you have high glucose. So you may need to be on it for a few months or sometimes longer. But when you take off these medications, there is a possibility that your glucose will come back to normal. Certain antipsychotic drugs, drugs to treat mental disorders or schizophrenia, also cause this problem. And the other thing we've seen is people who are very obese with the occurrence of diabetes, unlike a lot of people who are not so. So when they're very obese, if they manage to lose a huge amount of weight, they can actually control the diabetes. It can come back right down to even normal levels. In some situations, they can stop their insulin injections. They can reduce their oral medications. And I often challenge patients that way. I say, you know, the best is if you could minimize your medication. For the very obese, if they undergo a surgery called, we call it bariatric surgery, where you refashion the stomach and intestine, if you do lose that amount of weight, maybe 30-40% from your baseline weight, you stand a chance to cure diabetes. You stand the chance to cure other diseases associated with the weight excess, the blood pressure reverses, the lipids get better, the sleep apnea goes away, and the fatty liver also normalizes. I think rather than talk about cure, the message is prevention.
You are listening to our Best of Health and Living 2016 series, but this episode today is not so much focused on Health and Living, the radio show, but actually Health and Living, the health event, Health and Living Live. Up next, we address things like cancer, our love affair with food, the list goes on. So stay tuned. You are listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Health and Living on the Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. I'm joined in the studio by Health and Living producer Tina Camellia. And together and as a team and as a station, we all kind of worked on our very first health event that happened in April of this year. It was very exciting. It was lots of fun. I remember that day with a lot of fondness, actually.
That's right.
We did six panels covering the things that we thought were Malaysia's most pressing questions.
And one of the most fearful diagnoses that you can hear is cancer. So Lin, you spoke to the President of the National Cancer Society, Dr. Sondri Somosundrum, Consultant Oncologist Associate Professor Dr. Fuad Ismail, Subject Matter Expert in Herbal Medicine from Institute Cancer Negara, Dr. Lim Renjai, and the Medical Director of AIA Health Services, Dr. Miralini Santhirathasan. The panel discussed the challenges of managing cancer.
In terms of a perspective of an NGO and a patient group organization, I think the main issues that we have, one is stigma, which is still associated with cancer, and two, the fatalism that Malaysians have in relation to cancer. And because of that, people don't believe in prevention of cancer, people don't believe that cancer can be found early, and when cancer is found early, because of the fatalistic attitude and the stigma associated with cancer, they don't go for treatment early enough either. So everything snowballs. And then, of course, then your cost of cancer increases as well. Dr. Fuad?
I agree with what was said. I think one of our issues is there's quite a few cancers which can be detected early and people should go for certain types of screening. And number two is that when you are diagnosed with cancer, you should come for treatment because getting the diagnosis only doesn't help. You actually need to come for treatment. And there's a lot of stigma associated with treatment and people tend to look at chemotherapy or radiotherapy as very heavy treatment, but so they tend to shy away and they come back later, the disease is worse, and then they need even more treatment. So it sort of feeds their beliefs that the treatment is has a lot of side effects. And the third is the rising cost of cancer treatment now. There's a lot of new therapies. If we look back 20 years ago, there's only perhaps one or two new drugs a year. We probably get about 10 or 20 new drugs a year. And as the drugs are developed, they become more and more costly over time. So cost is a big issue now.
Exactly. I mean, riding on what Fuad said, cost is the major issue when it comes to cancer. And if you're talking about insurance, not everyone has any means of insurance to support that or to enable them to access the cancer care that they need when they're diagnosed with cancer. Insurance is a visible means of, you know, peace of mind that you have when you're diagnosed with a dreaded disease like cancer. So one of the main challenges in terms of cancer would be the cost. Knowing what's the right care that you should have, getting access to that care, getting treated, and getting diagnosed as early as you can so that your options for treatment is in abundance compared to when you're diagnosed at a very late stage. Then the cost escalates and then the access to that care will become a lot more challenging.
Dr. Lim, what about from a complementary therapy perspective?
What we observe the most is most of the patients, when they've been referred to our clinics, they have gone through most of the conventional treatments. So sometimes there's no active management, and some of them can't even take orally. They can't really take the medicine. This point of time, when they've been referred to our clinics, actually nothing much we can actually offer. That's one of it. So late referral is one of the concerns. Secondly, it's about the gap between the so-called traditional and complementary medicine practitioner with the conventional medicine. They don't really understand each other. So because of this gap there, it's actually delayed the treatment. I mean, it's a more appropriate treatment from a conventional side sometimes. And lastly, cost. Even in the complementary treatment, the cost is always a concern. You can't really imagine how heavy will be the burden of using complementary medicine. Here in Malaysia, we have set out a policy whereby the traditional and complementary medicine serves as an adjunct role. So in the other words, it's not an alternative for the cancer management. I haven't seen a single cancer patient with a tumor totally disappear after taking the complementary treatment. When we're facing cancer patients, one of the main things is they're so scared of oncologists. Well, you have radiotherapy, you have chemotherapy. By the time they listen to these terms, they ran away. And then they hope on me. So my next question is, I will discuss with them. I think one of the main challenges we have is to share the information with our patients. Whether they have enough information to make the decisions. So we do play a role when we're receiving this type of patients, whereby breast cancer, stage 1, about 94%, then why should you opt for something which evidence-wise cannot give you a promise? So why not get something else in the mainstream, get it done? Then you get cured. Isn't it better? Rather than opted for something else. That's actually our stance, especially in our center, and that's the way we're trying to educate our patients.
And since the theme was about addressing Malaysia's most pressing health concerns, we couldn't let it go without talking about our love affair with food, which is a serious one that has gone on perhaps too long. Ezra Zayed of Evening Edition spoke to consultant orthopaedic surgeon Dr. Harjit Singh, consultant dietitian Indra Balaratnam, and personal trainer Noel Chelia about how their respective industries and fields try to address this issue.
So as a personal trainer, I get a lot of people who come up and that's the help that they need. So they need advice on what they need to do physically, what fitness routines they need to do, and nutrition as well. I think many years ago, if you look at a fitness professional, the role of a fitness professional is really just show me what exercises to do and that's it. Nutrition is out of our scope. But the industry is starting to change. Fitness professionals are starting to realize that if we are not the ones who are also going to guide them and tell them what to eat, we're telling them how to move. If we are not telling them how to eat, but within our scope, I'm not going to give very, very specific recommendations because that always goes back to the dietitian. But what we're seeing nowadays is that you will see fitness professionals and trainers who are sort of like a hybrid. They have nutrition coaching abilities, which is absolutely essential because just moving alone and exercising alone, sadly, is not enough. And people don't know that. They think that if I go to the gym or if I go to a boot camp, if I hire a personal trainer, I'm done, I'm sorted. Just show me what to do for an hour. Leave me alone. That's it. But really, the challenge, I would say the exercise and the fitness is really the easy part because we all know what to do. We all know how to move. I can give you a workout program. Do this, you're done. The real challenge is really the remaining 23 hours of the day. Sleeping enough? What are you eating? So I think moving forward, the industry is seeing a trend where we can start to help that people. But until now, it looks like the trainers are taking care of the physical aspect and we have the dietitians after being referred to us by the medical pros.
I normally see the person as a patient. That means they probably already have an injury or something like that. Now, we then look back and true enough, most of the time, the trainer will teach the person the good way to move, the safe way to move, plus or minus the person has also done his own research on eating. Because I think that having a healthy lifestyle, being able to exercise, you're already making a healthy life decision. So you're already going to ensure that you're going to eat healthy. You are going to ensure that you exercise safe. And often you need to know your baseline of your exercise capability and where you possibly can safely start. Now, the level at which I could start and the level at which Noel probably mine would be just slightly lower. But I think that it's important to know your baseline and then start from there. And I always feel that the role of the nutritionist is also very, very important.
The problem with when you get on the internet and you do a search on anything, it's always the Western websites that come out first. I don't know whether it's because they have, you know, better search engine, better age. I don't know what it is. But the truth is, there are a lot of local websites out there that are equally credible that have very localized information. One of them is our Ministry of Health's website. We actually do have information there on nutrition done by the Nutrition Division in the Ministry of Health.
That is reflective of
Malaysia. Of our local foods, yeah. Yes. And our local nuances, the culture. So like alternatives to rice, you've got potatoes, you've got other grains, things like that that they talk about in there. So the idea is when you're doing your reading and all that, go to the local websites. If your diet is made up of more local foods, then go look for those kinds of information. So there are information on
But is it expensive?
It shouldn't be. The truth of the matter is a healthy eating diet consists of fresh, wholesome produce. It doesn't even have to be foreign produce. You don't have to go and buy the cherries or the very expensive foreign fruit. A lot of our local fruits like guava, papaya, bananas, they are no less nutritious at all.
It doesn't need the label of organic. It can be ulam at the pasar.
Nothing at all. Yes, yeah. Just going to your normal pasar tani grown by your local farmers, those foods are no less nutritious than anything that you're going to read about in the foreign websites or anything that has a foreign label on it. And on top of that, if you don't buy so much of the processed foods, things that come in a box, things that come in a can, you're actually saving more money. Those foods are cheaper.
Speaking of physical activities and mobility, we are also turning into an aging nation. Sharad Kutin spoke to consultant orthopedic surgeon Dr. Rajesh Singh and consultant geriatrician Dr. Tanmo Pin about the multidisciplinary approach to aging and recovery.
There are too many older people in this world, and we had not anticipated it. You would say, you should have figured it out. If your healthcare got better and you got richer and people lived longer, then you will end up having more older people. Well, we just kind of looked around and realized, whoops, help, we haven't really prepared for this. And this is a worldwide problem. So don't blame anyone. Everybody's at fault, if anything. We've not predicted this happening. And then with old age, at the moment we see it as a problem because we haven't prepared economically, we haven't prepared our healthcare facilities to cope with this, and our mindset are still on children, when actually by 10 years' time there will be as many older people as children in this country. And actually, we are a little bit behind because from the University of Malaya Medical Center point of view, we've just built a pediatric unit. I was like, we've just got a shrinking childhood population, and finally the pediatric units come up. So I'll have to wait another 20 years before the geriatric unit comes up. So we're a little bit behind. So we have to really think about this. We can play catch-up, and hopefully everybody can actually have a decent old age in the near future.
The nature of skeletal tissue, bone, ligament, tendon, muscle, cartilage, it's like a rubber band. So this is the concept that I, as an orthopedic surgeon, have, and my colleagues who work with the skeletal system have. We deal with your tissues. If you're a tailor, you know about fabric. When a woman walks into a store, she runs her hands across the fabrics because she tells by the feel of the fabric, good, not good, expensive, not expensive, good value, not good value. We have the same skill when we handle tissue. And that tissue, we look at as a rubber band. So if a young person gets injured, it's basically you've pulled too hard on a normal rubber band. If you have a rubber band that's got a little nick in it, you pull the rubber band tears more easily than it should. That's injury in the Middle Ages. And if you have a rubber band that you've left in the car for a very long time, you pull a little bit and the rubber band breaks. So if you have tissue injury due to brittle rubber bands, we'll call it that, you have loss of function and deconditioning. And then you have secondary changes and symptoms, and of course there's this issue of hormonal support if you talk about women and the menopause. If you have tissue injury due to brittle rubber bands, you can regenerate that to recover lost function. And if you correct your lifestyle and exercise, you can prevent secondary changes. So this is something really, really important. None of us can avoid getting older, but all of us can avoid suffering the consequences of getting older.
A lot of the problem is the mentality. People think, oh, I'm old. It'd be so embarrassing to do these kind of things. But actually, there are people who are still very active in their old age. You can be 100 and you can run a marathon. Nothing's going to stop you. But the key thing is to actually maintain that physical fitness. So if you can, just keep going. As soon as you reach the peak of your physical fitness around 25 years old, it's not 30, but I think he's pushed it to 30. If you are able to exercise, eat well, you can maintain your physical fitness. And you need to keep up with the youngsters. So you need to keep up with change. And so learning is lifelong. Okay, so if the latest iPhone has just come up, you jolly well make sure you know how to work it. Because otherwise, if you miss this iPhone, next time it's a doubly hard job to learn about what the next iPhone does. So you need to keep up with the generations, you know, do things that youngsters like so you feel young. It's as simple as that. But often it's a perception of society. Like, I get very irritated because I'm not allowed to carry anything at work. So I was like, how am I supposed to grow muscles if I'm not allowed to lift anything? So often society also frowns upon the older person doing things.
And finally, we closed off the event by addressing the future, since we are aging. Aging eggs and the sperm count crisis. Meera Sivasodhi spoke to fertility specialist Dr. Prashant Nakani, consultant obstetrician and gynecologist Dr. Premitha Damodaran, and consultant urologist Dr. George Lee about how to address fertility issues.
Being more relaxed and being more into yourself and just being, you know, zen helps stabilize a woman's hormones, makes her feel good. The quality of eggs that come out that cycle might be much better. I mean, it's just like telling a couple who's trying to get pregnant, go for a holiday. Just, you know, go at that particular time when you're ovulating, just go for a holiday, go for a nice beach holiday. Don't think about anything. Have enough sex as you can, you know, and lots of sex. And for all you
what
know,
is lots and lots of sex, by the way?
Your definition and my definition might vary.
I want to know who has more sex.
We all want to go on holiday with her.
Okay. Close. How much sex is lots and lots of sex?
And you may come back pregnant. It's just like, I'll tell you stories of how many patients whom, you know, have come to see me for fertility, and I've said, look, just calm down, but go and visit Prashant. And a good number of them actually come back pregnant because they had more sex there.
Go and visit Prashant and they come back pregnant?
Not what you think. Not what you think.
I'm sure there are laws against that, right? Oh, dear.
It's a hand. Bless.
But sometimes, George, it's just a simple thing. The guys don't want to come forward, Dr. Premitha. But if they do come forward, George, sometimes it's just a very simple problem.
When they come to see me, majority of them, we have so many sperms, right, in there. And the vast majority of them actually needs a bit of advice about when is the right time to have sex. You know, because you have no idea how scared men can be. You know, whenever they're faced with problems like that, they don't talk to anyone, and then they just assume that, you know, you're supposed to just get on and do it, right? Because that's a culture that you expect. And the other thing which not many people realize, that what you did in your past may come back to haunt you, such as if you have been naughty and then get all sorts of diseases in the past, and that might block the sperm ducts. And that's when we come in to actually retrieve those sperms, harvest those sperms for you, and actually help you with, you know, fertility work. And lastly, some people are just born genetically to have obstructed sperm duct. There's a condition called congenital bilateral aplasia vas deferens. And for many, many years, many people assume that it's so rare that it doesn't exist. And increasingly, we're seeing more and more of these men. And then there are simple technology that can overcome such obstacles.
George, I think you're just drumming up business here. What you need to tell them is stop smoking, stop drinking, lose some weight. There are more obese people in the world than slim people in the world. We're heading in that direction. You see, a man's testicles hang outside the body because he produces about 60 to 80 million sperm a day. That's normal. That's, if you had a factory that produced 60 million TVs a day, it would be an enormously hot factory. And so you need to hang them out. Now, that is because if you get fat, imagine in that man where his testicles are going to be. You're not even going to be able to see them. They're completely surrounded by fat. The heat is not being dissipated, and that's one of the biggest causes of that dropping sperm count that you see, is sedentary jobs, big fat men sitting on chairs for 8 or 12 hours, and then sperm count drops. So losing weight, reducing smoking, and reducing alcohol.
An ideal BMI, your hormones are working perfectly. When you lose too much of weight or you do too much of exercise, what happens is your whole endocrine system goes a bit crazy. And so even though you might be feeling really good and very, very fit, but your whole system is not working. So that's why you have athletes who really do in a lot of exercises and they're really, really fit, but they don't get their periods very regularly. So they don't ovulate. And you need to ovulate to get pregnant.
So if you're 25 and you've been trying for 12 months, in the next month, your chance of getting pregnant is 10%, which is not bad. This is per month. If you're 40, it's 3%. And if you've been trying for 2 years, which really isn't a long time, then you're 40, your chance is only 1% a month. So it drops drastically. And you can see the difference as you age.
Our next health event is coming up next year, probably in April sometime. We'll keep you posted for sure. Let us know, what would you like us to cover? What are the things that you wish you could ask a doctor directly? We will bring them right to you and you can grill them. Let us know. That email is biggerpicture@bfm.my. And again, if you want to catch any of these shows in full, they are all available for download as podcasts on our website, but also on our app, which I would urge you to check out because it is very cool. You are listening today to Health and Living. This is BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.